Good morning. How many of you are familiar with The Walking Dead? A TV show called The Walking Dead. Okay, about half of you. Okay. Morgan got me hooked on that. And I started watching in early spring, and I'm clear up to season 5. So, kind of obsessed with it, I guess. But I really like it. And but they kind of, it irritates me, they kind of dismiss Christianity. And, you know, kind of a... Anyway, so anyway, that irritates me. So then I found this book, and got all my papers out of it. It's called The Tribe, and it's about soldiers coming home from battle, war, and having their troubles they have in getting back into civilian life. And I was really hooked. The first story, which I'm going to read to you, really got me hooked. And then he immediately goes into evolution and some anti-Christian stuff. And it's like, irritate me again. And it took me about 6 tries to actually get through this book, because I'd read through it and get to this point where he's talking about evolution and this stuff, and I put it down, and his political views and stuff. Anyway, so it took me quite a while to get through this book, and it's a small book and big print. Anyway, but it irritates me that Christianity is kind of a thing to make fun of, and it's the thing that people poke fun at, seems like. So, and I think, well, I believe that it's the ultimate, it's the ultimate thing that's going to make everything okay. And it irritates me when people poke at it like this. So, that's kind of why I got this lesson. So, as I'm reading, I want you to think, what does this have to do with the church? And what does the church have to offer in these situations? So, okay, first story. In the fall of 1986, just out of college, I set out to hitchhike across the northwestern part of the United States. I'd hardly ever been west of the Hudson River, and in my mind, what waited for me out in Dakota and Wyoming and Montana was not only the real America, but the real me as well. I'd grown up in a Boston suburb where people's homes were set behind deep hedges or protected by huge yards, and neighbors hardly knew each other. And they didn't need to. Nothing ever happened in my town that required anything close to a collective effort. Anything bad that happened was taken care of by the police or the fire department, or at the very least, the town maintenance crews. In parentheses, I worked for them one summer. I remember shoveling a little too hard one day, and the foreman telling me to slow down because, as he said, some of us have to go through a lifetime of this. In parentheses. The sheer predictability of life in an American suburb left me hoping. All right, now this is what I identify with, I guess. The sheer predictability of life in an American suburb left me hoping, somewhat irresponsibly, for a hurricane or a tornado or something that would require us all to band together to survive, something that would make us feel like a tribe. What I wanted wasn't destruction and mayhem, but the opposite, solidarity. I wanted the chance to prove my worth to my community and my peers, but I lived in a time and a place where nothing dangerous ever really happened. Surely this was new in the human experience, I thought. How do you become an adult in a society that doesn't ask for sacrifice? How do you become a man in a world that doesn't require courage? Those kinds of tests clearly weren't going to happen in my hometown, but putting myself in a situation where I had very little control, like hitchhiking, like hitchhiking across the country, seemed like a decent substitute. That's how I wound up outside Gillette, Wyoming, one morning in late October 1986, with my pack leaned against the guardrail and an interstate map in my back pocket. Semis rattled over the bridge spacers and hurtled on toward the Rockies 100 miles away. Pickup trucks passed with men in them who turned to stare as they went by. A few unrolled their window and threw beer bottles at me that exploded harmlessly against the asphalt. In my pack, I had a tent and a sleeping bag, a set of aluminum cook pots, and a Swedish-made camping stove that ran on gasoline and had to be pressurized with a thumb pump. That and a week's worth of food was all I had with me outside Gillette, Wyoming, that morning, when I saw a man walking toward me up the on-ramp from town. From a distance, I could see that he wore a quilted old canvas union suit and carried a black lunchbox. I took my hands out of my pockets and turned to face him. He walked up and stood there studying me. His hair was wild and matted, and his union suit was shiny with filth and grease at the thighs. He didn't look unkindly, but I was young and alone, and I watched him like a hawk. He asked me where I was headed. California, I said. He nodded. How much food you got? He asked. I thought about this. I had plenty of food, along with all the rest of my gear, and he obviously didn't have much. I'd give food to anyone who said he was hungry, but I didn't want to get robbed, and that's what seemed was about to happen. Oh, I just got a little cheese, I lied. I stood there, ready, but he just shook his head. You can't get to California on just a little cheese, he said. You need more than that. The man said that he lived in a broken-down car, and that very morning he walked. The man said that he lived in a broken-down car, and that every morning he walked 3 miles to a coal mine outside of town to see if they needed fill-in work. Some days they did, some days they didn't, and this was one of the days that they didn't. So I won't be needing this, he said, opening his black lunchbox. I saw you from town and just wanted to make sure you were okay. The lunchbox contained a bologna sandwich, an apple, and a bag of potato chips. The food had probably come from a local church. I had no choice but to take it. I thanked him and put the food in my pack for later and wished him luck. Then he turned and made his way back down the on-ramp towards Gillette. I thought about that man for the rest of my trip. I thought about him for the rest of my life. He had been generous, yes, but lots of people are generous. What made him different was the fact that he had taken responsibility for me. He had spotted me from town and walked a half a mile out a highway to make sure I was okay. Robert Frost famously wrote that home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. The word tribe is far harder to define, but a start might be the people you feel compelled to share the last of your food with. For reasons I'll never know, the man in Gillette decided to treat me like a member of his tribe. This book is about why that sentiment is such a rare and precious thing in modern society, and how the lack of it has affected us all. It's about what we can learn from tribal societies, about loyalty and belonging, and the eternal human quest for meaning. It's about why, for many people, war feels better than peace, and hardship can turn out to be a great blessing, and disasters are sometimes remembered more fondly than weddings or tropical vacations. Humans don't mind hardship. In fact, they thrive on it. What they mind is not feeling necessary. Modern society has perfected the art of making people not feel necessary. It's time for that to end. That story got me hooked. That was I go through that constantly. It's like, look at my life. Like, it's beige, no salt. And, you know, nothing happened. You know, boring. So, anyway, been thinking about that, and that brings up, you know, this guy and The Walking Dead. You know, they got a different take on things. They don't look at it from a Christian standpoint, and they look at it from the human side of things, which makes sense. And but we tend to look at things, this is about me, okay? You guys, I'm going to say the majority of you guys do a lot better job at what this guy recommends than I do. So this is written for me, not for you guys, so, and it's what's been on my mind, so. Survival, you know, I talk a lot about that, but what is the Christian view of survival? I mean, what is it? Our survival is not based on how long our life is or how comfortable our life is, but on how well pleasing and glorifying we are to God. I mean, it doesn't matter if my life is 30 seconds more or 30 more years. That doesn't matter. That's not the point of my survival. The point of my survival is how I bring glory to God. And I'm going to read the verses go along that. 1 Peter 1, 3 through 9. And these have been, like I said, I've been, meditating on these. I wouldn't say that I meditate on anything more than a couple seconds, but I was noticing that during class, and the Lord said, well, I mean, we're talking about Christ's sacrifice, and my mind was everywhere else, not even related, and it's, anyway, side note, sorry. 1 Peter 1, 3 through 9. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to His great mercy, He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Though you have not seen Him, you love Him. Though you do not now see Him, you believe in Him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. So in other words, my survival would be salvation, wouldn't it? I mean, that's the whole point of it, right? The only reason I'd want to survive this life would be to prolong it and to do more things for God, right? That's what Paul's dilemma was, wasn't it? It's like, it's far better for me to go and be with Christ, but it's far better for you, the fellow Christians, to stay here and bring more glory to God. Rough paraphrase. So, and then another thing I've been, since I'm in a service type job, Philippians 2. Philippians 2, 12 through 18. 12 through 18, I guess. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, But now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work, for his good pleasure. Do all things. This is, Morgan made me this little card, I don't know how many years ago now, but it used to be on the dash of my van, but now they took away the crack in my, they redesigned the dash, so I can't stick the card in there anymore. But this is very important. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life. So that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain, even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith. Even if that's what I keep remembering, even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me. Those things are hard to do. Do all things without grumbling and complaining. We were talking about that in class. You know, you get somebody at work. I mean, it gets to the point where I just don't want to hang around with certain people at work, because as soon as you stop for a second, they're grumbling about something. I was grumbling to Mariah this morning about my work week's about to get longer. They're adding more hours to it. I'm going in at 7 now. And, you know, don't get off any earlier. But it's overtime, so why should I complain? But I do. I complain. And it's hard not to. And why? And then what's that do? So that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish. Okay, so that's who we're bringing glory to. That's why we don't complain, is because we're children of God. And we know we're in a crooked and twisted, we're in a messed up world, among whom you shine like stars. That's why we don't grumble and complain, because that little spark of, well, why don't they grumble and complain? That's going to shine like, the reason soldiers don't smoke on sentry duty. It's like a red dot scope, you know. It's like, shoot here. So, that's why they don't smoke. Just a little bitty thing, but it's seen for a long ways away. So, anyway. So anyway, what does the church have to offer this? How can the church help in any of this? People are looking for this. Why is the Walking Dead? Why is it so popular? What draw does it have? I think it's exactly what they're talking about in this book. He has three things. All I got to do is find it. He has three things that affect how soldiers come back from battle and are reintegrated into society, and how they do that successfully. For one, they need cohesive. They need acceptance. People who are going to... I got to say this word. I kept reading this book, and this word kept popping up. I was like, what in the world does that word mean? Finally, we Googled it and found out what it meant. But I'm not sure I can say it either. All right, I got it spelled phonetically here somewhere. Egalitarian. There we go. Egalitarian means relating or believing in the principle that people are equal and deserve equal rights and opportunities. I read that and I'm like, Well, that's the church. I mean, we're egalitarian, apparently. Because who would we exclude from the church? If you want to be in here, then come on in. I mean, we're going to do all we can to make sure you're welcome. That's what soldiers need. When they come back, they need people to accept them. They need people to say, you know, I don't quite understand that relationship. I'm not claiming to understand that relationship, but that's what they need. And that's what people need. People need accepted. And that's like The Walking Dead. What do? I mean, they keep pulling people out of messes, and they don't know them. Come find out they got a totally different background than everybody else. They got Orientals, they got blacks, they got whites, they got gay, they got straight, they got male, they got female, and they're all in this group, and they fight together, and they share food, and they, you know, it's very church-like. And that's what people are looking for. Okay, and cohesion. What's cohesion? Cohesion is they stick together. You know, I'm killing my zombies, okay? And what I don't see is the one sneaking up behind me. This is for those of you who don't know what The Walking Dead is, there's these... I didn't really want to go into this. But there's these dead people that aren't dead, okay? And they're walking around. They're trying to eat people, okay? So it's very, very... I think it relates a lot to the church because I got problems, okay, that I can't seem to get rid of, okay? I got these problems that I kill it, it falls down, and I think, I got it mastered. We were talking about that this morning. I turn my back on it, and I'm going this way, and that thing pops back up, because I didn't stab it in the brain, and pops back up, and it's attacking me again, and one of you guys comes up and stabs it in the eye, and we're done with it, okay? I mean, I don't know, it's crude, I understand, but I think it applies, because that's, I see a connection, okay. But that's the cohesion. People, I'm willing to do for you what you need done. Okay? What, no matter how gross it is, no matter, I mean, when I was a CNA, I did all kinds of things for people that I wouldn't think about doing normally. You know, you clean people up, give people showers, you know, that kind of thing. It's not pretty. But it's what you do. That's cohesion, sticking together, that unity, that bond. And that's what they got in the military, right? You're sleeping with these guys. You're 3 feet, boom, 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 3 feet away. They're snoring, you're snoring, they're talking in their sleep. You don't have this bedroom wall that keeps you separated and all this stuff where I have my life, you have your life. They have this togetherness, this tribe type situation where they come back here and all of a sudden they got their own house and they can go days without even meeting anybody when they're used to eating with somebody, going to the bathroom with someone. You know, everything they do is with somebody else, a whole like 20 somebodies, and they're fighting with and protecting each other, and then they come here, and it's all... I mean, I get in my van in the morning. I might see my family in the morning. Some of the times I don't see them in the morning because I leave before they get up. And I get in my van, and I drive off to Ottumwa, you know, and I get out, I see a stranger fix their window, and I work all day with strangers, and then I come back home, you know, and... Think of what that would be like to somebody who was used to being with their buddies, you know, people you would fight and die for constantly. And then all of a sudden you're on leave or undeployed. There's a connection there. And they found that connection in Sarajevo, you know, the Bosnians. I mean, Sarajevo is a city. I don't know how good your history is. Mine wasn't very good. It was this big city, Bosnian Muslim city, down in this valley. Well, the Serbs attacked it. They got both the mountains on either side. The city is completely cut off. They had snipers up on the mountains that would just randomly, somebody would be out in the street walking. Down there you go. And they just shoot them. It was terrible. I mean, they couldn't get food. They couldn't get water. Things were bad. And this guy was, I think he was a reporter over there. It was one of his first jobs. And he went back, interviewed some of the people over there. And they were actually missing when they were under siege, because when they were under siege, they were all living in the basements together. They were sharing their food, they were sharing their time and their space, and they had a bond that is probably totally unlike anything we can even understand, because we don't live that way. We don't live that way. And I think that's what the church has to offer. I mean, I think we have an appreciation for it, because we come together and we have this bond that we're experiencing now, where we talk about our problems. We talk about our ugly problems and things that make us cry and, you know, this kind of thing. And we share that. But I think there's a whole lot of people out there who don't have that experience, don't have that, and they're looking for it. Okay. All right. Now that I've told you about it, I guess I'll read about it. In 1961, Fritz, let's see, who's Fritz? I guess he'll tell you here in a minute. Fritz assembled his ideas into a lengthy paper that began with a startling sentence. Why do large-scale disasters produce such mentally healthy conditions? Now, I found that interesting, because taking this guy's research as being right, said depression rates dropped during World War II in London, and suicide rates dropped, and, I mean, schizophrenic and stuff like that dropped, because people had a cause. They knew exactly what they were going to do. And the bombing of London, I mean, there were hundreds of people in these bunkers. They said the floor was just a wash in urine. I mean, it was bad. I mean, it was an ugly situation. And people actually were saying that they missed it. And one Londoner was saying, maybe we could do it just one night a week, and it would just bring back that camaraderie again that we had. They found out that in interviews and stuff that the one lady, Londoner, said, we would have went out on the beaches and fought the Germans with broken bottles if we would have had to. I mean, if that's what it would have taken. It says it didn't demoralize us in the least. People still went to work. They still did their jobs. I mean, you know, if it wasn't blown up. And they kept doing that. And then the exact same thing happened on the other end of the war when we started bombing, doing that to Germany itself. The exact same thing happened in Germany. Their morale went up and their resolve was actually pulled together, and they fought even harder. So it's just kind of, it's just the opposite of what one would think. Okay. Why do large-scale disasters produce such mentally healthy conditions? His data was compiled by a team of 25 researchers who had worked for the National Opinion Research Center based at the University of Chicago. Their job was to rush to disaster sites and interview the inhabitants about how they were adapting to their new circumstances. By 1959, NORAC researchers had compiled... NORAC is the acronym for National Opinion Research Center. Had compiled roughly 9,000 survivor interviews. Fritz also scoured academic publications for anything related to natural or man-made disasters. His study was conducted during the height of the Cold War, when Russia's nuclear threat was foremost in the minds of civil defense planners. Never mentioned in the report, though impossible to ignore, is the possibility that the study was intended to assess whether the United States could continue to function after a nuclear exchange with Russia. Fritz's theory was that modern society has gravely disrupted the social bonds that have always characterized the human experience, and that disasters thrust people back into a more ancient, organic way of relating. Disasters, he proposed, create a community of sufferers that allows individuals to experience an immensely reassuring connection to others. Now, this is what I think the church has to offer. The church does this. This is the church's job. I mean, we don't need a war. We don't need a tornado. We don't need a hurricane. We don't need any of this stuff because we have a spiritual battle. We are fighting a spiritual battle that is raging around us 24/7. You know, I was talking about killing the zombies. I mean, those things are... the old man, I'll call him, is sneaking up on us every chance he gets. We talked about the devil finds out you got a chink in your armor here. You know, he's going to just keep nailing that. And you're going to either have to support it yourself or have help from somebody else to support it. Okay. So... That allows individuals to experience an immensely reassuring connection to others. As people come together to face an existential threat, Fritz found class differences are temporarily erased, income disparities become irrelevant, race is overlooked, and individuals are assessed simply by what they are willing to do for the group. It is a kind of fleeting social utopia that Fritz felt is enormously gratifying to the average person and downright therapeutic to people suffering from mental illness. Fritz's conclusions were later borne out in a study of the city of Uruguay in central Chile, which was struck by a devastating earthquake and a rock slide on May 31, 1970. 90% of the population of Uruguay died almost instantly, and 70,000 people were killed throughout the region, roughly equivalent to a nuclear strike on that area. The rock slide that buried the city put so much dust into the air that helicopters couldn't land, and the survivors of Uruguay were left completely on their own for days. Into this terrifying vacuum, a new social order quickly sprang up. Concepts of individual private property temporarily submerged. Anthropologist Anthony Oliver Smith later wrote in his paper, Brotherhood of Pain, "The crisis also had an immediate status-leveling effect on the nascent community of survivors it had created. A sense of brotherhood prevailed as Indian and Mestizo, lower and upper class, collaborated in the collective efforts to obtain immediate necessities and survive. As soon as relief flights began delivering aid to the area, class divisions returned, and the sense of brotherhood disappeared. The modern world had arrived." So, we are the church. I want to focus on the church here. We have this to offer to people. Galatians 3:26-28 talks about there's not Greek or Jew, male, female. I can't remember all of them. Yeah, bond or free, yes. And then the last part says, "For you are all one in Christ Jesus." So that's that egalitarian term. Everybody, we're all the same race. I heard an interesting, I can't remember if I was here, or somebody said there is no races. It's just melatonin. I mean, we're all the same people. I mean, Oriental, black, white. It's just how you react to the sun, you know? And it's kind of the same thing with Jesus, isn't it? It's all how you react to the sun. So, I mean, we don't have races. That's just a division that people put in there to, you know, make things that way. And in Romans 15, 5 through 7, it talks about, I can't tell you what it talks about, but the end of it is, "Therefore, welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you." And I mean, who isn't welcomed by Christ? So who shouldn't we welcome? Nobody. So, and then for the glory of God. That's how we bring glory to God, is how we welcome other people. So, and then Jude 21 through 25, it talks about, this is for the cohesive part, you know, what you would do for other people. And it says, snatching some of them out of the fire. So, I mean, you're actively doing something to help somebody. And then in Galatians 6, 1 through 5 says, "Restore one gently and watch yourself, so that you don't fall into the same trap." So we have to be very careful. You know, you can help somebody and then have this exact same problem sneak up right behind you and whack you over the head. So you have to be very careful. And then it talks about bearing others' burdens. And then I never quite understood this. It says, bear other people's burdens. And then it says, like one verse later, bear your own burden. And one of the most important things in this book was, do not label vets that are coming back as victims. Don't let them see themselves as victims. Because as soon as they become a victim, then it's somebody else's job to take care of you. And that's not what we were told to do. Where did I write that down? Acts 2:38, or 39, somewhere in there. Where is it? Men, or what do we do? You know, they were convicted. They knew that they had crucified Jesus and killed the Son of God. And they said, what do we do? They didn't go, oh, it wasn't us, it was the devil. We're victims of the devil. No, they took responsibility for what they did. And then they did something about it. They were baptized, and they became part of the church. They became part of that family, that tribe. I was very interested in Wednesday night. We were talking in Judges 18, in verse 7. This is the Danites, okay? They're out hunting for a new place to live because they weren't tough enough to take the place God gave them, I guess. So they found another place. It says, verse 7, "Then the five men departed and came to Laish and saw the people who were there, how they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth and possessing wealth." That sounds kind of like the United States, doesn't it? We have everything. We're living in luxury. We're secure, or so we think. "And how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone." And then what happened to them? The Danites went and got all their 600 brothers, and they went and they attacked it, and they took it. And that's kind of us. You know, we're in this spiritual war. It's hard for us to remember that because it's spiritual and we're physical. And so we can't see it. We don't have groaning zombies coming out of the bushes and coming after us. We don't have people busting in the front door and trying to take us out in some manner. We don't have to worry about that. So we're fat and sassy and living a pretty good life. And so we don't even bother to look out our windows and see what is out there. And so, and spiritually speaking is what I'm saying. Spiritually, we're doing this and we don't realize that the devil is sending his forces after us. And if we're not careful, they're going to take us out. They will come and take us out. So, what I want you to remember is we tend to forget that we are in a battle. That this is a battle. We are fighting. I mean, every day we fight against something. And or at least we should be fighting against something, or aware that we should be fighting something. And I think since we're Americans and living in the Western society that we have here, that we tend to do it by ourselves. We tend to, I know I do. My first instinct is to, if I can't kill it by myself, then I guess I'm going to die. You know, that type of thing. And there's no reason for that. No reason whatsoever, because I have all you guys. That's what the devil likes to do. He likes to get us by. That's what he wants us to do. I think he has set us up with this society, at least us anyway. Maybe he's probably got plans for other parts of the world that work. But for us, this is working. He gets us. We're on our phones, you know, and that gives us, I think, a sense of security or connection. But we don't really. I call it the Facebook thing, like my tomatoes. That's a perfect analogy. I took one picture with my tomatoes that were taller than me. Okay. Everybody's, oh, those great tomatoes, you know. I don't know how many people have asked me about those tomatoes. For years I've had those tomatoes. Never been asked about them before. But that's a Facebook thing. I'm not out there standing in front of my tomatoes. They're standing about this high now because the wind blew them over. They're uprooted and they're turning brown and the tomatoes are rotting. No. That's not what I want you to see. I want you to see me standing in front of my 8-foot-tall tomatoes. No, but what really is happening is I'm struggling and fighting for my life, and everybody's still looking at my 8-foot tomatoes and thinking, he's got it all together. And that's not true. So, we need to be cohesive and kill each other's zombies that are behind us. Okay, each of us. In that show, I love it. No matter how tough, how good of a fighter in that show, I know some of you don't know what I'm talking about, but you got this military guys, you got a sheriff guy, you got people that are natural-born killers, and they're out there slaying these zombies, and every time there's one zombie that's up beside him, and some nerd comes up and sticks a screwdriver in his head, and down he goes and saves him. Somebody who is not a fighter, who's not a natural born fighter, saves the warrior, you know. So I mean, that's the way it is. That's the way we need to be. We need to be there for each other. And I think we spend too much time by ourselves, what I think. Or I spend too much time by myself. And that's natural for me. That's the way I naturally am. You give me a spare moment, and I don't say, who can I call up and beat, spend time with? No, it's like, all right, I got a minute. I'm going to go by myself, and I'm going to do something by myself. That's what I naturally do. That's not what is healthy for me, maybe, perhaps, all the time. So, anyway, fight for your brothers and sisters. That's my thoughts for this morning. I hope it made sense. So, this is the church here. We have the truth, okay? We have the way to please God. We have the ultimate survival. We have a group that's going to work together. We have what the world is looking for. We have companionship. We have acceptability. We have you are important to our group. No matter what your skills, no matter what, you have something that we need and can contribute. So, if you want to become a part of our group, come forward as we stand and sing the closing song, and we can help you with that.